Egypt's Mohamed Morsi, dead at 67, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The former Egyptian president was on trial in Cairo when he collapsed.
After he has given his statement, he fainted, then we've taken to a hospital. It's a really dramatic incident.
Morsi's troubled legacy after the Arab Spring, plus ship captains feel the tension between the U.S. and Iran.
The whole shipping industry is holding their breath right now, whether there will be a U.S. response and what shape that response will take.
Being blind and speaking a foreign language can be isolating here.
I feel like a lot of Spanish-speaking folks are already marginalized, and then you add the visual impairment to it as well, the blindness.
But new devices make it easier for visually impaired Spanish speakers to hit the movies. That's ahead on The World. A shock in Egypt. Former President Mohamed Morsi was on trial in a Cairo courtroom today when he suddenly collapsed. A short while later, this announcement came on state TV.
توفي اليوم محمد مرسي العياض أثناء حضوره جلسة محاكمته في قضية التخابر.
Morsi was dead. He was 67. Morsi was the only freely elected president that Egypt has ever known. He won the elections that followed the pro-democracy protests there in 2011, a highlight of the Arab Spring. But Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood party proved divisive once in power. And in July 2013, the Egyptian army staged a coup, ousting Morsi and killing hundreds of his supporters. Morsi has been in jail ever since. Magdi Abdelhadi is an Egyptian-born analyst. We reached him in London today. Magdi, what's your reaction to Morsi's death?
Well, the dramatic manner in which it happened is perhaps the most remarkable thing about it. But as far as political consequences are concerned, hardly any. The Muslim Brotherhood as an organization is more or less crushed inside Egypt, even though it might still have some support within the general public. Tragic for his family, of course.
What about Morsi's political role in Egypt? Can you give us a sort of bullet point list of Morsi's role in Egyptian politics?
I interviewed President Morsi when he was a member of parliament for the Muslim Brotherhood back then in the early 2000. He's, of course, like many of their members, senior members, they're academic, they're professors, they're doctors, they're engineers who believe firmly in an idea that Islam somehow miraculously can solve all Egypt's problems. And when the uprising happened and toppled Mubarak, he was one of a group, actually, who were in jail, and there was a jailbreak out, and they were free. And they eventually created a political party to contest election. And
this was all in the heyday of the Arab Spring.
Of course. Now, part of the problem, of course, that the people who started the Arab Spring were not Islamists. They were young secular professionals. The Muslim Brotherhood was reluctant to join them. But after the initial success of the protest movement on the streets, the Muslim Brotherhood, to many people's understanding, including myself, opportunistically seized the opportunity. And they were the only people who had an organization who knew how to run elections. And they won parliamentary elections, and subsequently they even won the presidential election. But as I said, they quickly alienated many of the people who supported them reluctantly, even though they were not themselves Islamists, by trying to grab as much power as possible. Many realized that the Muslim Brotherhood are not going to turn Egypt into democracy, but another authoritarian regime with an Islamic tag.
And then there's the coup on July 3rd, 2013, and he is out. And basically, Morsi was in prison for the last 6 years under pretty brutal conditions, really.
I lost count, actually, of the number of court cases in which he was found guilty and he appealed. He got death sentence, and that was rejected by a higher court. And this was a retrial, actually, where things he was being retried on, I think, a jail breakout and espionage and many other similar charges. I think that what this particular tragic development today will once again refocus the light on the jail conditions, which has been highlighted repeatedly by human rights organizations. Terrible embarrassment for the Egyptian government, which insists that the conditions are good. But sadly for anybody who cares about human rights and democracy, the world is just simply too busy. I think Egypt, by all accounts now, is a dictatorship, sadly, for the Egyptians, of course.
Magdi, what is Morsi's legacy, in your opinion? I mean, how will Egyptians remember him?
His supporters, of course, regarded him as the new caliph, and he was sort of a godsend, the man who would lead Egypt into a bright future. Some of them continue to entertain these kind of mythological accounts of what he could have achieved, but in reality he will be remembered as the victim of various power struggles within the Muslim Brotherhood itself, and he has achieved very little.
Magdi Abdelhadi is an Egyptian-born analyst. He's typically in Cairo, but today he's speaking to us from London. Thanks a lot, Magdi.
Pleasure.
In the meantime, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is stepping up the Trump administration's case against Iran. Pompeo is blaming the country for the attack on two oil tankers in the Gulf of Oman last week. Iran denies the charge as tensions between Washington and Tehran continue to climb. Meanwhile, the Iranian government has announced that it plans to exceed the limit on how much enriched uranium it's allowed to stockpile. That limit is part of the 2015 nuclear deal, the same agreement that the U.S. withdrew from last year. Now, Pompeo is saying that the U.S. is considering a full range of options for dealing with Iran. Suzanne Maloney is with the Brookings Institution's Center for Middle East Policy.
I think that the administration is considering an array of possible options, including an inevitable military response to what is a rising tempo of Iranian-related attacks on shipping and transportation in the Persian Gulf. There are also, of course, additional sanctions that the administration will look to apply. This has been the go-to tool of the Trump administration, economic pressure, and it has had a significant impact on Iran's economy. I think a key element of the administration's response will rely on being able to rally the international community.
What does Pompeo want from Iran at this point? I mean, have his goals changed since the attack on two oil tankers last week?
There are a number of steps that the administration would like to see in terms of scaling back Iran's support to terrorist groups and militant proxies across the region. There are also, of course, decisions that Iran is unlikely to ever adopt, such as shuttering its nuclear ambitions and its nuclear program. We've seen very little progress in terms of realistically meeting any of those demands. But it's interesting to note that Pompeo and others from the Trump administration have recently begun publicly asserting that those demands are not, in fact, preconditions for dialogue, that they are, in fact, prepared to meet the Iranians anytime, any place, and to engage in a fruitful discussion around the concerns that the administration has about Iranian policy.
How are European countries reacting to this? I mean, is the U.S. likely to get support for whatever option the Trump administration decides to pursue against Iran?
We've seen a variety of responses so far from the Europeans. The British have come the furthest in terms of backing up the Trump administration's assertions that Iran is responsible for these tanker attacks. Meanwhile, of course, the German foreign minister was openly skeptical and demanded more evidence. When push comes to shove, however, the Europeans are likely to move closer to the Trump administration on this particular issue simply because they have no other good option. The Iranians are upping the tempo of their own activities, not just in terms of regional attacks, but also in terms of nuclear activities that will soon breach the limitations that were imposed by the 2015 nuclear deal. That puts the Europeans in a terrible position because, of course, they're trying to preserve that deal, if at all possible, but they can't simply condone Iranian violations of it.
Is there a scenario where the U.S. might have to rely on the UAE or Saudi Arabia for support instead of European allies?
Well, I think the UAE and the Saudis will support American efforts to put more pressure on Iran and even limited strikes against Iranian targets, if that is a decision taken by the Trump administration. But even they, I think, are somewhat skittish about the prospects of a full-blown conflict in the region because, of course, it would have direct implications for their own stability and for their own economies. If Iran were to try to close off the Strait of Hormuz, the United States could certainly undertake actions that would reverse that, but it would be very messy, very costly, and it would likely result in a broad set of consequences and military fallout across the region. And that wouldn't be, I think, in the interests of either the Emirates or the Saudis. For the Trump administration, going into an election year, precipitating a conflict that would not only conceivably involve significant deployment of American military personnel and assets to the region, but also have potentially catastrophic impact on oil prices and on the broader global economy. But I don't think that that's the first response that the Trump administration, despite a lot of tough talk, is likely to utilize. And it's exactly the kind of scenario that our European allies are trying to prevent.
Suzanne Maloney, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Secretary Pompeo vows to guarantee the passage of ships through the Strait of Hormuz, but the growing tensions between the U.S. and Iran bring a heap of uncertainty to the shipping business. Jacob Larson is head of maritime security for BIMCO. That's the Baltic and International Maritime Council based in Copenhagen. Larson is the security guy for owners of most of the world's commercial fleets, and he's been busy since the explosions last Thursday aboard two fuel tankers in the Gulf of Oman.
My first instinct was that this represents an escalation of the situation that we currently have in the region. On the 12th of May, we saw four tankers being attacked. And now this incident with two tankers being attacked by something, we don't know yet what it is. So my initial thought was, this is an escalation. And then, of course, second thought was, what now? What will happen now? And I think the whole shipping industry is holding their breath right now. They are awaiting the results of the investigations. And then, of course, whether there will be a U.S. response and what shape that response will take.
And what sort of advice does BIMCO give these captains of tankers and cargo ships now in this interim period where investigators are still trying to figure out what caused these attacks?
Basically, we advise them to keep extra lookout, increase the deck patrols, perhaps maneuver with their propellers and their bow thrusters and stern thrusters to create a difficult environment for any hostile diver trying to place a limpet mine on the ship while at anchor or in port. These are the kinds of measures you can take, and while they will not completely guarantee that a ship is not being attacked, it would at least make it more difficult for the attacker and perhaps inspire the attacker to choose a different vessel to attack. So this is what we can do now, mitigate the risk as much as we can, and then just have to accept that there is a certain level of risk.
So if this current situation escalates further, what are the implications for trade? What are your concerns?
First of all, my concern is with the seafarers. We fear for the seafarers' safety. That said, I think completely staying out of the region is not really a viable option in the long run. And that would also mean that those that try to interrupt the regional trade, they would have won. But my concern is really that the trade volumes will go down, and with that, the oil prices will come up. It could have an impact on the global economy, and when the global economy slows down, it also has a negative impact on world trade transported at sea generally.
Has there been any slowdown of merchant ships through the Strait of Hormuz yet because of these latest attacks?
It is probably a little bit too early to say exactly whether the movement of oil out of the Gulf has slowed down. I know that a number of the ship owners I have spoken with, they have said that they are not taking ships into the area just now because they are waiting for clarification as to what exactly happened. So while we may not have seen the trade slow down yet, I don't think we have the numbers in yet, but I think if this level of uncertainty persists and if we see another attack of this nature, I'm quite sure that trade volumes will begin to come down.
Jacob Larson is head of maritime security for BIMCO. That's the Baltic and International Maritime Council based in Copenhagen. Thanks a lot, Jacob.
Thank you.
You're listening to The World.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. You might have seen in your TV's menu an option called video description. It's an embedded voice that explains out loud what's happening on the screen. It's especially useful for people who are visually impaired. This service is available in most movie theaters and even at some Broadway shows. But in the U.S., it's almost always in English, for now at least. Jason Strother reports on efforts to make audio description less monolingual. He starts off in Passaic County, New Jersey.
I'm at a multiplex in suburban Wayne Township to catch a movie that I've been dying to see.
Could I have one ticket for Rocket Man?
But instead of popcorn, I ask for something else to bring into the theater.
Do you also have the audio description device for visually impaired guests?
I'm legally blind.
Could I have one, please?
The device is a small transmitter box with a pair of headphones. When the lights go down, it syncs with the film.
My name is Elton Hercules John.
And in between dialogue, a disembodied but gentle voice whispers in my ear.
He's still in the orange high-collared costume and cap. He wipes away a tear, then smiles.
The audio description helps me follow along with some of the action on the screen.
Reggie dances through the groups of fighters. He ducks back through the gap in the fence and dashes down the alley. He jumps out of the way of speeding motorcycles.
Since 2017, the Americans with Disabilities Act has required all movie theaters to provide audio description services, and that's changed the way many people with visual impairments experience going to the movie theater.
It used to be that I would have, like, my parents describe to me what was going on, or friends that I was with. That's a thing of the past now.
Nefertiti Matos, who's in her 20s and blind, tells me how friends helped her out at the movies.
And they would literally be whispering to me throughout the movie. You know, like, oh, he dropped kicked that guy. But you're also mindful of the people around us that are going, shh, we're turning around and saying, can you guys shut up? Or are you going to talk through the whole movie?
Matos is an assistive technology trainer at the New York Public Library. And thanks to audio description, she now goes to the movie theater with other blind friends. But she grew up in a Spanish-speaking household, and so sometimes she'd like to hear audio description in Spanish. She says accessibility services for non-English speakers is becoming more inclusive, especially audiobooks. But when it comes to the movies, Spanish speakers are left out.
I feel like a lot of Spanish-speaking folks are already marginalized, and then you add the visual impairment to it as well, the blindness. People, especially who go blind or lose their sight progressively, they feel like their world is just closing around them. They're not able to take in things like they once were able to.
But the accessibility language barrier is slowly coming down.
Anuncios importantes.
Maria Jose Garcia Vizcaino teaches a class on Spanish audio description at New Jersey's Montclair State University, the first of its kind. She learned about audio description from her legally blind sister back home in Spain.
And being a translation professor, I was just fascinated by the multiple possibilities that you can do with language. This is a kind of translation too, because it's a translation not from one language into another, but from one medium into another. So you are going to translate from the visual medium into the oral.
Garcia Vizcaino says many of her students grew up speaking various versions of Spanish. These differences came out when producing the audio description track for a short film from Spain.
There was a scene that the main character threw something to the garbage. So one of them said one word that in Dominican Republic, they say garbage this way. And then another, no, in Colombia, we say that way. And I said, you know what? None of them work. Because in Spain, nobody knows those words.
Garcia Vizcaino's class also partnered with New York's Repertorio Español to introduce Spanish audio description to live theater. This trial run took place during a performance of El Coronel No Tiene Quien Le Escriba. Translation, No One Writes to the Colonel, a play adapted from a novel by Colombian writer Gabriel García Márquez.
El coronel asiente.
Graduate student Vanessa Carrillo describes the action on stage. She watches the show on a black and white monitor from inside the theater's costume room. Visually impaired audience members listen on headsets.
Lleno de huecos.
After the curtain call, I speak with audience member Saeed Golnabi.
Have you had much experience before seeing theatrical performances?
Zero. That's my first time in a theater.
Really? Wow.
First time.
Yeah. Why hadn't you gone in the past? Is it because of the visual complications? Or?
I guess mostly I would say the vision, yeah.
Golnabi, who's 58, adds he's probably only ever been to movie theaters a couple times in his life. But he says that could change now that audio description is more available. Also in the audience was the New York Public Library's Nefertiti Matos. She says she hopes this isn't a one-time-only event.
For Spanish speakers, we're very, you know, folks, we love entertainment and all this, and the talent here is incredible. If you offer it, I feel like we will come.
Other theaters don't have to follow suit. There's no requirement that they have to provide audio description in any language. But many visually impaired Spanish speakers hope it happens in live theater and at the movies. For The World, Jason Strother, New York.
Argentina's government says, don't worry, there are zero chances of a repeat of yesterday, when a massive power outage left the entire country and all of neighboring Uruguay without electricity. Argentina's energy minister, Gustavo Lopetegui.
Esa falla no es algo anormal o extraordinario.
The minister said the malfunction that triggered the nationwide blackout was not unusual or extraordinary. What was extraordinary, he explained, was that a single failure on a single line led to a cascade of failures that shut down the entire national electric grid. That led to chaos on the roads because traffic lights didn't work for hours, and people were stranded in Buenos Aires high-rises because the elevators didn't work. These two residents of the Argentine capital shared their experiences with the BBC.
Everything came to a halt. Lifts, water pumps, everything. We were left adrift.
The fridge thawed and I couldn't go out because the lift wasn't working. I could only come down when the power came back.
The blackout also affected regional elections taking place in parts of Argentina yesterday. The voting went ahead, with many people casting ballots by the glow of their cell phones or by candlelight. Early results show opposition candidates doing well. Not good news for President Mauricio Macri or his government as they scramble to explain how the entire country was plunged into darkness on their watch. Argentina, like other nations, has limited power outages all the time, but this was a blackout on an entirely different scale. Reporter Natalia Cosoy says it will be weeks before investigators can say how the power failure spread so widely.
The suspicion lies within a power line that comes out of an electric dam in the north of the country, in the border with Paraguay. And it's suspected that something happened in that power line that triggered an automatic response from the network that made it stop altogether. But up to this point in the government, they don't want to say definitely what have happened because they say they are still investigating what the reasons behind that trigger were.
Reporter Natalia Cosoy in Buenos Aires. You're with The World. I'm Carol Hills. You want a taste of Antarctica? Literally?
Okay, so I'm going to try some maybe 2,000 or 3,000-year-old mud.
Yeah. You don't have to put it on your tongue, just between your teeth, so you can just go like this.
Our reporter explains what old mud and ancient shells in Antarctica can tell us about our climate future. That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Million people. Organizers in Hong Kong say that's how many turned out to protest yesterday against a controversial bill that would allow extraditions to mainland China. Hong Kong's government had already suspended the bill from going forward, but the protesters want the proposal to be scrapped entirely. Man Kei Tam is director of Amnesty International in Hong Kong, and he was at the protest yesterday. Man Kei, what are you feeling like today after yesterday's dramatic statement by the protesters?
I feel Hong Kong people, such great people, they made miracle in two consecutive Sundays. We demonstrate ourselves very peacefully with a huge turnout to retake the streets and to raise our concerns and demands and call on Carrie Lam's government to withdraw the bill and also to withdraw the claim that last Wednesday's protest was a riot. And we also call on her government to hold accountable the officials that involved in the violence and the misses involved in the whole legislation process.
Of course, Carrie Lam is the chief executive of Hong Kong. Man Kei, what were the streets of Hong Kong like today, Monday?
After the protests ended officially last night, some of the protesters occupied one of the main roads next to the government building until early in the morning. They retreated. And then in the afternoon, they retook one of the roads again to protest against Carrie Lam and demand her to face the protesters and answer the demands of yesterday's protest.
What do you see as your role there in Hong Kong during this time of protest?
In the past 2 weeks, Amnesty played the observer role, and on the two Sundays protests, we were one of the participants. We were one of the crowd who swarmed the streets.
Man Kay, on a personal level, are you hopeful at this point about where these protests are going and the response, or are you concerned?
I think so far we have been pushing the government, and it is obviously a step forward for the protesters and the people. What I also noticed in the protests is that Hong Kong people care their homeland. For example, one of the most chanted slogans, "At Oil Hong Kong," means "Hang in there, Hong Kong." And then they also care about the students who were arrested or beaten up by the police in the clashes. And many of them are peaceful protesters. And then they also care about each other during the protests.
Do you see the protesters themselves? Did it start out as one group, and then with each new protest, there's kind of more and more different types of people, and that who the protesters are? Does that keep changing, or is it consistent?
I think it has been evolving quite organically. More and more small groups joined in that involves ordinary citizens, people who advocate independence or self-determination, and some of them are professional groups like lawyers, teachers, and journalists, of course. So more and more. And the latest group joined in were parents, because they want to protect the students who represent the future of Hong Kong.
Man Kay Tam is director of Amnesty International in Hong Kong. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
As the protests over the now-suspended extradition bill continue, Beijing is suggesting that foreign powers are behind the upheaval in Hong Kong. My BBC colleague Zhao Yunfeng has been following this from her post in Washington, D.C.
The Beijing government, it did not directly accuse the U.S. of its role in the protests, but state media did indicate that the Hong Kong protests might be instigated by foreign powers such as the U.S. This claim is usually used by the Chinese government for a lot of internal domestic issues. And it's hard to say whether they truly believe it or it's a scapegoat used by them to direct the attention of people. But a lot of people in mainland China suddenly believe in such a theory.
Now, Carrie Lam, the chief executive of Hong Kong, she suspended this very controversial extradition bill. Where does that leave Chinese President Xi Jinping and his power in Hong Kong?
The suspension of this law is actually pretty extraordinary. If you think of it, it could be the biggest concession of Beijing government and President Xi make to public pressure, because such a thing doesn't happen in mainland China. And such a concession made by the Hong Kong government and backed by Beijing is actually damaging the image of President Xi. Whether Beijing or Hong Kong government will make further concession, we're still waiting to hear.
I want to switch gears now and talk about next week when President Trump will meet with Xi Jinping at the G20 in Japan. What do you anticipate the U.S. will be pressing Xi and China for regarding Hong Kong?
Last week, when President Trump was asked by reporters regarding his view on the Hong Kong demonstrations, he actually did not give a very straightforward answer. He said he hoped and believed that Hong Kong and China can work this out. And if we turn the clock back to 5 years ago, during the Umbrella Movement of Hong Kong, another pro-democracy movement in the city, Trump at the time actually tweeted about it and criticized the Obama administration of being too involved into the Hong Kong affairs. So this kind of shows you President Trump's possible view. Well, Secretary of State Pompeo did indicate that if Trump will meet President Xi during G20, he will bring up the Hong Kong issue in front of the Chinese president. But how deep will Trump discuss it? It's really hard to say at the moment. And U.S.-Hong Kong relations is defined by an act called U.S.-Hong Kong Policy Act. in which it says that the U.S. president has the right to stop giving special benefits to Hong Kong when Hong Kong's degree of autonomy is considered not sufficient anymore. So that's in the U.S. policy tool. However, whether Trump will use that right is hard to tell at the moment.
Let's get back to the protests themselves, specifically the concerns around surveillance of protesters. What are some of the precautionary measures that protesters in Hong Kong have been taking?
Some of them have been wearing masks, partially as for protecting themselves from pepper spray, but also it can serve the purpose of covering their face so they can't conceal the identity in front of CCTV cameras. A lot of them have been downloading the chatting app Telegram, which is considered more secure and safe than other chatting apps. And notably, Hong Kong people are refrain from using Octopus Card, which is the metro card in the city. And it's hugely popular. Hong Kong people usually use it not only for transportation, but buying things from convenience stores. However, a lot of them during the demonstrations are trying to get the one-time single ticket for metro rather than using their metro card.
They don't want a record of where they've been, so they're exactly. just paying for each ride they take instead.
Yeah, they want to hide the paper trail.
Now, is there a worry that the Chinese government is going to go after protesters? I mean, is there any evidence that they're monitoring cameras and images being posted online?
It's not a secret that the Chinese government monitor people's social media use and also their internet communications in mainland China. However, there's little evidence that such an action exists in Hong Kong by the Beijing government at the moment. But the demonstrators are certainly taking measures to avoid that.
My BBC colleague, Zhao Yunfeng, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
A quick update now on the case of Carlos Ghosn. He's the former chairman of the Nissan and Renault car companies who's been fighting charges of financial misconduct in Japan. Ghosn was first arrested last November, then released, and then rearrested on April 4th. His wife, Carol Ghosn, was there when police stormed their Tokyo apartment at 5 in the morning and took her husband away. The former executive is now out on bail.
They told him one of the bail conditions, the restrictions, is he's not allowed to speak to me or talk to me, which I find inhumane.
Carol Ghosn told the BBC that her husband is innocent and the victim of a conspiracy by other executives at Nissan. The car company strongly disputes that and says there's substantial evidence against its former CEO. Meanwhile, his wife is asking President Trump to get involved when he's in Japan next week for the G20 summit.
I'd like President Trump to speak to Prime Minister Abe about fair conditions, fair trial conditions, and to let me speak to my husband, and also to respect this presumption of innocence until proven guilty.
That's Carol Ghosn, wife of the former Nissan CEO Carlos Ghosn, speaking to the BBC. Hundreds of migrants who crossed the U.S.-Mexico border in recent weeks have made their way to Portland, Maine, and they're stretching that city's resources to the limits. These migrants are not from Mexico or Central America. They're from much farther away, as in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Angola. And now that they're in Portland, Maine, they're getting help from people like Claude Raganje. He's Congolese and directs a group called Prosperity Maine, the Center for Financial Education. Raganje says many of the new arrivals have been on the road for up to 4 months and have traveled through as many as 11 countries en route to the U.S.
The majority fly to Brazil, and then they start the journey through the buses, mostly, and other walking.
So it could be a plane, a boat, but it definitely includes lots of walking and then eventually a bus ride from San Antonio.
Definitely. Once they landed in South America or Central America, really walking was a big issue for them. And I feel so bad. Little children, mothers who are pregnant, the others, I was talking to a mother who are actually delivered in Panama, and I was talking to others who delivered actually in Mexico. So I wondered how they really did this journey. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that journey is more than 10,000 miles. It takes months. Do these migrants know that when they start the journey? Do they know what's ahead of them?
I really doubt, because if they knew how long it would take them, somebody could really reflect twice before they can put a pregnant woman on journey or even a baby in a journey without knowing the outcome. You might reconsider taking such a risk.
Why are migrants from the Democratic Republic of Congo and Angola, why are they heading to Portland, Maine? I mean, it's certainly not a familiar climate for these migrants.
Every group, once they migrate, they go where the friends and the family member are. Portland, Maine has been a welcoming city for many immigrants, Angolan and Congolese. So when you communicate back home, people know where you are. Newcomers, they tend to go where the other immigrants have resettled.
So they go there because there's already people from the Democratic Republic of Congo. There's a community already there, so that's what attracts them.
And also, I will add that the city is also a welcoming city to many immigrants.
It certainly has done a lot to welcome the new arrivals. Here's Maine Governor Janet Mills describing how her state is responding.
Obviously, we're handed a situation here with, by fate, by circumstance, by hand of God. And there are those who might want to make it political. I don't see it that way. None of us here sees it as a political issue. It is a humanitarian issue. The broader community of the people of the state of Maine are going to be lending a hand and helping these people who are in such dire need. They call upon us, and we will be there for them.
The governor seems to be welcoming those in need, but at the same time, the migrants' numbers have really deluged shelters and attorney caseloads. Portland officials are kind of overwhelmed, aren't they?
They are. This is an opportunity for us. It might look like a challenge at the beginning, but long term, this is an opportunity for Maine to bring these people to us when the border is closed, when migration is trying to be closed by the Canada administration. So we are very grateful to have these people coming to us. I know it might be a challenge for the city, but again, we are responding as community, as stakeholders, as corporations. So it sounds like a crisis to some, but it's an opportunity for many.
Portland has even had to turn its basketball arena, the Portland Expo Center, into an emergency shelter. And I know you and your staff have been there translating and helping out in other ways. Tell us what the scene looks like there with some 200 African migrants sleeping on cots.
When you go to the Portland Expo, first of all, at the entrance, you have to have either a badge. You have to be signed up as a volunteer to get in because there is a police at the door. Of course, there are beds everywhere, maybe a couple hundreds. And then you see some tables, interpreter agencies, medical screening. Lunch and breakfast and dinner is served. We line up some tables there. And then on the other hand, you have kids playing. They created a little station where there is some cartoon. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful to see these children finally have a place where they can spend a day without traveling.
Portland doesn't have a formal asylum assistance program. So these people who are arriving, they're unlikely to get all the help they need. And as more of their friends and family members are on the way, isn't this going to turn into a bit of a crisis? I mean, is it sustainable to keep welcoming more and more people into Portland?
Portland may be overwhelmed on its own, but definitely we expect more cities to support as well. So once we send these migrants into different cities, I don't think this is going to be a big deal again for the city of Portland alone.
Is there anything any of the migrants have said to you that particularly moved you?
Yes. One thing that they said, we are glad that we have reached a safe place. We can't go back to our home country. Here is our home country.
Claude Waganje is from the Democratic Republic of Congo. He's lived in Maine since 1996. Thanks, Claude.
Thank you.
There's a huge amount riding on what happens to just one glacier in Antarctica. It's called Thwaites Glacier, and how much it melts and how fast will help determine the fate of coastal cities around the world. So scientists are studying Thwaites and the warm water that's melting it from below. The World's Carolyn Beeler recently spent time with those scientists aboard a research ship, and as she tells us, they're also interested in how the glacier has behaved over the past 10,000 years.
To predict the future, the scientists aboard the Nathaniel B. Palmer are digging into the past, just off the coast of West Antarctica's Thwaites Glacier. That means looking at a lot of old mud and seashells. We'll start with the mud. There's a long metal tube of it being lifted from the seafloor onto the back deck of the Palmer on a windy day in West Antarctica.
We are slowly lowering it to horizontal right now with the winch, and everybody is standing under the overhang.
University of Alabama sedimentologist Becky Manzoni says it's like sticking a giant metal straw into the seafloor.
The sediments or the mud that you find in these big straws, they are like pages in a book.
As you go deeper and deeper, you can read the history of nearby glaciers. In the fossils embedded in the mud and in the layers of sediment the glaciers deposit as they retreat and advance.
So essentially what we do as geologists is we walk back in time through each layer in the core to date these book chapters as accurately as we can to reconstruct this long-term history.
All right, let's count. 1, 2, 3.
Becky and several other scientists on the ship's deck lift the 10-foot metal tube of mud onto a wooden cart.
Hands out of the way.
And wheel it into a lab. When it's laid out on a long white lab table, it's the color and texture of Nutella. Becky will lean in for a closer look with her tiny magnifying glass. And she surprises me by saying she puts the mud on her teeth to feel its texture. So, of course, I have to ask her.
Can I give it a try?
Yeah,
is that allowed?
I spit out my gum.
Okay, so I'm going to try some maybe 2,000 or 3,000-year-old mud.
Yeah.
Becky laughs at me for actually tasting it.
You don't have to put it on your tongue, just between your teeth, so you can just go like this. Is it gritty? Its texture is like the toothpaste they use at the dentist. You're trying more. Sorry. It honestly doesn't taste bad. It's just like salty.
You can wipe it off if you want to. It's up to you. You can swallow it or you can...
It's done now.
When I'm not distracting her, Becky's doing serious work here. Scientists think a current of warm water called circumpolar deep water is being pushed under Thwaites Glacier and melting it from below. What Becky's trying to figure out is if that warm water has ever reached the glacier before and what impact it had if it did.
How is the glacier responding to that? Did it retreat at that time? Did it advance at that time? Did it just remain stable?
If that warm water has been here before, it would have left evidence on the sea floor, including the shells of microscopic creatures that live in this layer of warm water. So Becky's searching for them, kind of like looking for fingerprints at a crime scene.
And it's always a surprise when you put them under the microscope. It's like, what are we going to find? And in this case...
She finds one of those fingerprints, a cloudy, white, spiral-shaped shell. Becky's PhD student, Victoria Fitzgerald, points one out on a screen that's connected to a microscope.
It's got like a funny little, looks like an ice cream cone with an ice cream on top of it and little antennas falling off the side. He likes living in circumpolar deep water.
Now, this shell came from the surface of the seafloor. It suggests that this warm water is here right now. Becky and her colleagues still have to analyze the older samples farther down in the core to look for clues of whether this warm water was around in the past. These findings will eventually be fed into sea level rise models.
That will help us feed the modelers with more information about what's realistic for how Thwaites Glacier is going to respond to future climate change.
Worst case, the collapse of Thwaites could trigger around 11 feet of global sea level rise. So getting this right is a big deal, and the ship scientists are using lots of different methods to look into the past as a window to the future. On a nearby island just off the coast of West Antarctica, Scott Braddock is working with another one. He's on his stomach, digging into the rocky beach with a spoon. The University of Maine PhD student is looking for fragments of old shells to carbon date. It's tricky because these shell fragments look exactly like the pebbles covering the beach.
It's frustrating to start. Until you have an eye for what you're looking for after a few, you could skip right over them and never know it.
The shores of this tiny island have a series of terraces stepping down toward the water. It looks kind of like a tiered wedding cake. That's because as the glaciers around here shrink, the bedrock underneath them rebounds from the weight of all that ice. The island we're standing on has slowly emerged from the water, tier by tier.
And what we're doing is going up beach terrace by beach terrace, and each one we're digging into them and looking for shell samples.
Once the shells are analyzed back in a lab, they'll tell Scott how old each tier of the beach is.
It's diving into the past. It's telling us what changes were going on with Thwaites and other glaciers in the area. And you can read those changes by knowing what the sea level was doing in the area.
We built
Together with other records, this information could show scientists whether Thwaites retreated quickly in one giant leap or over time in tiny steps, and if it re-advanced again. Eventually, this will help scientists predict future melting and how our coastlines will change over the next 100 years. These shells and sediment samples are the raw materials of science. It'll take months to tease answers out of them. On this day, though, Scott will be on this island until late at night, laying on his belly under the 24-hour Antarctic daylight, digging holes with his spoon and covering them back up.
It's relaxing. Sometimes you just pick your head up and you see icebergs around, massive glaciers, penguins, skuas on the islands, so...
For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Okay.
Carolyn has been reporting all this spring on the quest to understand what will happen to the glaciers of West Antarctica. Her reporting includes photos of the researchers at work and an audio diary recorded by a scientist on Thwaites Glacier. It's all at our website, theworld.org/Antarctica. And next week, Carolyn will have the story about Joey Patterson. She's a ship staffer whose 9 trips to Antarctica have brought her face to face with the impacts of climate change. But like a lot of us, she tries not to think about it too much.
In the same way that I have to compartmentalize the risks that I'm taking by simply being on a boat in the middle of the Southern Ocean, I also have to compartmentalize the risks that are being presented to me by the way that our climate is already changing. Otherwise, how do you get up in the morning?
That's next Monday here on The World. From the Nan Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.